This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. The holidays mean more travel, more shopping, more time online, and more personal info in places that could expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second. If your identity is stolen, their U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed or your money back. Get more holiday fun and less holiday worry with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Yup, that's me, Brian Kilmeade. Britt Baer standing by. Michael Wiley, RNC chair, standing by. Will he lose his co-chair? Lara Trump is the next senator from Florida when Ron DeSantis gets a chance to look at this. How do you turn her down? I mean, Byron Donalds, you would think, but they can't lose somebody else in the House. And if a Trump wants it, who's so competent, how do you not get it? Give it to her. And she said she's open to it. So that's interesting. We have President of the United States welcoming the Boston Celtics to the White House today to celebrate their victory as he winds things down. But he's still making an impact before he gets out the door. Before we get to Brett, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Matt Gaetz is not the best choice, and it's not Republicans who have dirtied him up. This is a guy who stood on this floor of the House and drove the House into chaos. He's burned bridges with the Republican Party.
Yep, it's true. He's going to have an uphill battle. He was on Capitol Hill yesterday. That was Mark Thiessen, Trump team two. Pete Hegseth is there now in the halls of the Capitol with Vice President-elect Vance. Gaetz taking on his critics yesterday. He's going to go head-to-head with them soon in a couple of months. And Trump again making history with a crypto czar. It seems like it. We'll talk about it.
Number two.
Elon and I are going to start a separate track of Dogecasts that explain exactly what we're doing to the public, to provide transparency, to lift the curtain, to take us behind the scenes of what actually that waste, fraud, and abuse in government looks like.
The Doge duo, Elon and Vivek, detail their mission and their methods of the massively shrinking, how they massively plan on shrinking the government, eliminating trillions from the budget. Headwinds are forming, but they have a secret weapon, the American people.
Number one.
This horrific individual robbed us all of our hopes and dreams for Lakin. Your Honor, I'm asking you to please give Jose Ibarra the same thing he gave us when he made the choice to take Lakin's life and destroy ours.
Yep, that is Allison Phillips. She asked for no mercy for Jose Ibarra, the killer of her daughter. Lakin Riley's senseless, horrific murder, whose killer was convicted and sentenced within 2 weeks. Exactly why Donald Trump was selected as president, in my view, because her killer would never have been in the country, never been flown to Georgia, and his remorseless demeanor in the face of the murder shows the urgency, and yet blue states and blue cities are going to resist the Trump push to get them out. Brett Baer joins us now, chief political anchor, best-selling author. Brett, welcome back.
Hey, bro.
Brett, it was like a made-for-TV show, made-for-TV, although it was too real. The Lakin Riley trial. I mean, we see the killer right in front of us. We see all the testimony. We see everything, except the actual murder itself. And then we don't have a jury. We get a verdict within 20 minutes. It really, the horror was so outlined and so available for everyone to see.
Yeah. And some of that police body cam video and going to the scene and it's heart-wrenching to see, and I think it was indicative. It obviously played a role in what now the president-elect talked about on the campaign trail about the danger of this across the country, and it's not isolated as far as the concern about this. So it was a big, big case, and I think, it was – really touched the hearts of a lot of people around the country.
I know, and the thing is, it's the pace of it was almost unheard of, but the story is not going away. It just underlines Tom Homan and his mission, and he's not shy about hopping on camera and talking about what he has to do and why he has to do it. Cut one.
I think President Trump needs to make a phone call down there and tell them they're going to stop that caravan, that they're going to have consequences like he did before. And to the, if you want to spend every...
I'm sorry, cut two. My bad.
The government failed the Lincoln Riley family. Not only, if President Trump was president, he'd be sitting in Mexico in the Remain in Mexico program. And if he did get to New York and he was arrested for injury to a child in New York, ICE would be able to arrest him because the priorities under Trump were if you're in the country illegally, you're a target. But because Secretary Mayorkas put the priority so low, even the injury to the child didn't meet the standards, so ICE could even place a detainer on him. So this is purely, it could have been prevented. This young lady's dead. And I want every mayor, every governor of a sanctuary jurisdiction to listen to that tape, listen to this young girl fight for her life, fight for her breath, trying to survive, terrified. Think of the, I want you to understand what she went through.
And I think we all know what she went through, and that's what he's talking about. And it's the president, for president-elect, who put on Truth Social thoughts about the family. Nothing from the White House that I could see.
No, and listen, remember, this was not a name that was frequently mentioned by either President Biden or Vice President Harris. I mean, they kind of had to be asked questions about it before they mentioned that name. So, listen, this case is going to be something that they that Holman and others point to. I think they have a big job ahead, and what that looks like exactly as far as deportation, I think, is a really big question. The sanctuary cities and the mayors and the governors who are trying to Trump-proof, you know, illegal immigrants inside those places are missing the message, I think, that Americans sent in the election. And, you know, there'll be probably consequences for that in one shape or another, and we just don't know what it looks like.
So we have the mayor of Boston. We have the mayor of Denver. We have the governor of Massachusetts all saying that, and the governor of Illinois all saying that we're going to push back against this. We want to keep our sanctuary status. They say per capita, Brett, Denver has more illegal immigrants than anybody else. They're living on the streets. They've taken over Denver. They've bled into Aurora. But yet the mayor, who was open to enforcing the border when he talked to Fox and Friends earlier in the year, now says he is going to stand up for his values and stand up against Trump and stand up for his residents for all. And he's going to, he says, and if they come in with troops, it's going to be a Tiananmen Square situation. I mean, I think they're missing the communication with what the American people want. It's safety. I mean, they don't understand the difference between someone who's working the fields in a California farm and someone living in a migrant shelter who's member of a Venezuelan gang.
Yeah. Listen, it's a major disconnect. If you look at our Fox News voter analysis about what voters really cared about, immigration was way up there, if not one or two. And the concern about safety is a big part of that. Now, to hear, you know, Democratic lawmakers and Democratic analysts say, you know, when you start deporting people, the price of groceries is going to go up is really kind of rich. If you think about, you know, all of the explanation about inflation and how it was going to be transitory at the beginning, and it took a while for them to you know, acknowledge that people were feeling pain when they went to the grocery store. Now, because of deportation measures that they don't know what it's going to look like, they're saying groceries are going to go up. I think, listen, we're going to see how this goes. I think criminals, terrorists, gangs, that's where the focus is first, to try to take that illegal criminal element out. How it goes from there, I don't think they're kicking in doors to get grandma, but I don't know, and I don't think anybody really knows.
So the other thing is, just to bring you globally, they're going to try to Trump-proof the president's hope to get rid of the illegal immigrants in our country. At the same time, Joe Biden's administration is launching a brand-new ICE app, and it's going to take root in December, allowing illegals to bypass in-person check-ins, beginning in New York City, making it harder to track them, and knowing how glitchy the app is intentionally, it's going to make it almost impossible. And even if it was working great, you check in, it does not show past arrests or outstanding warrants. It allows you to check in and keep your illegal your status that you can stay. It's immediately going to be accessible to 100,000 migrants. This is going to make it harder for ICE to find you and find out if you're a criminal. This is resistance to the end, Brett.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of that stuff can be literally turned over on January 20th at 12:01. But seeing that effort and the extent to which it's happening should tell you, you know, where the mindset was and how there is a disconnect to what Americans voted for. When you have the popular vote, no matter what the spread is, a win for Donald Trump in the popular vote and an electoral college win of 312 to 226, that's a message. It may not be a massive landslide, and there's all kinds of analysis about that, but it is a clear message that people are concerned about it. And what's happening in between now and then, the inauguration, should tell you a lot about where their, you know, this administration's thought process was.
So let's fast forward to Ukraine before I have to let you go and you get on with your life. It's fascinating what's happening over there, because they now got permission from Joe Biden a year and a half late, as usual, to use the ATACMS and aim them wherever they want. And at first we heard reports that they said restricting our allies from doing the same. But then we find out the Storm Shadow, the UK's version of ATACMS, was also released and goes into Russia. Russia's response with a ICBM missile rocket, and they're beginning to hit Kyiv even harder. Your thoughts about where this is heading?
Well, not a good place, but it is a pushback that I think is setting the table for what eventually will be an invasion. I mean, to read between the lines of Zelensky's message back when I interviewed him on the front lines, Trey Yingst interviewed him the other day, I hear an effort to push back hard and to set the table is what I hear. Now, I think that the real concern was the 11,000-plus North Korean troops that were getting towards the border and the ability to push back against them. By the way, they're getting a lot of payment from Russia for sending those troops over. And Putin is, you know, in a serious problem when it comes to manpower. So, you know, for all the talk and the saber rattling about nuclear weapons, I do think it changes the dynamic and maybe, you know, lays the groundwork for whatever President-elect and then January 20th President Trump will do.
Right. We don't know if they're even consulting. I talked to Mike Waltz on Monday. He says, no, we have not been briefed on any of this. He's going to be the national security advisor to Trump. John Olyat, he's a former Trump national security aide. Got a book out about the Biden foreign policy and said this about the escalation, cut 28.
It's absolutely a big deal if it's true, just as you said. What this is, this would represent a major escalation by Russia in the war against Ukraine. And this follows on what the Biden administration did just the last couple days. They allowed for attacks, directly long-range attacks, 130, 190 miles, up to 190 miles into the territory of Russia that's never been authorized before. These are U.S. weapons. If true, this ICBM that was launched for the first time against Ukraine, this would mean a major escalation, really a response to the provocation that the Biden administration is doing in the last throes. We got 2 months going in this administration. President Trump has said that he's going to ramp this war down. And suddenly, why are we provoking the Russians and then having a tit for tat?
Right, because he feels though he's the opposite policies of Donald Trump, and we'll see if they get to the table. There are indications that Putin wants to talk. I don't know what he wants to say, but he does want to talk. Brett, are you hearing that?
I am, yeah. And so, you know, what's producing that? Why is that happening? Maybe because these long-range missiles are landing inside his territory. You know, who knows? There's a lot of backstory here, and there's a lot of things that are happening behind the scenes. And I wouldn't be surprised if when President Trump gets in office that this hasn't laid the groundwork differently as far as Russia wanting to talk. They haven't wanted to talk up until this point.
And we just know, too, one Western official just said that ICBM was not used in the attack on Ukraine. But go ahead.
Yeah. I think Russia is legendary for a lot of saber rattling. But they know if they ever used any size nuclear weapon inside Ukraine, it would be devastating for Russia. I mean, completely devastating. So there's a lot of questions about foreign policy. But in the end, I think that, you know, the Mike Waltzes of the world, the other voices inside advising President Trump are going to be of the mindset of scaling back, but in a way that that America looks strong.
Hey, Brett, do you have your picture panel yet?
You know, I'm going to just get off this phone and think about it. And then, no, I don't know who's on today, but Britt Hume's in the mix.
You know what would be great is if you went on the street and picked three random people. You bring them in the studio, and you just roll. Have you thought about that?
I mean, that's Jesse Waters' deal, isn't it? I mean,
that's not special report material.
Johnny, he sends Johnny out there. Yeah. Right. Listen, maybe sometime. Maybe sometime. That's good. And when are you going to come back on the panel? You need to.
Just waiting for an invitation. It can't be an email. It's got to be hand delivered.
Hand delivered. All right.
That's all. Hand delivered. I just got to know a little bit about the other people on the panel, and then I'm going to consider it. I mean, if those are, if as long as you don't need a quick answer.
Yeah. I've seen you in action. I know.
All right. You've had enough of me. All right. Fred Fair, thanks so much. Have a great show.
We'll see you.
All right. Consequential Times, 1-866-408-7669. Pete Hegseth now walking the halls of the Capitol. He's going to be talking to set senators about what he would do as Secretary of Defense. We wish him all the best. And I bet your recruiting's already picked up. But the thought of somebody who actually fights wars, cares about the military, and making sure the people that sign up are taken care of, even when they're done, I think that's going to help recruiting immediately. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. The holidays mean more travel, more shopping, more time online, and more personal info in places that could expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second. If your identity is stolen, their U.S.-based restoration specialists will fix it, guaranteed or your money back. Get more holiday fun and less holiday worry with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Would the Massachusetts State Police assist in mass deportations?
No, absolutely not. I think that the key here is that, you know, every tool in the toolbox has got to be used to protect our citizens, to protect our residents, and protect our states, and certainly to hold the line on democracy and the rule of law.
Yeah, that would certainly help, and we'll see where that goes. Because we're looking at a situation, where no one is holding the line, nobody, and we have a wide open border. And I just heard Mayorkas and the FBI director are not showing up for today's hearing to try to explain the breakdown at the border and various other illegals that have gotten in. Something about swearing in on their testimony. You know what they're both looking at? Mayorkas is going out the door. He's been a disgrace. Hopefully he'll never get hired again. Please don't give him $1 for his speech. And Christopher Wray knows he's going to be fired. They're already interviewing people for his job. So that, to me, shows that he's got to be done on top of that. When we come back, I'll expand on what's going on with the Trump team as they build out this uphill battle some of the nominees have to getting confirmed. And what Donald Trump wants to do, get this with crypto, put a czar there. I think it also shows for a 78-year-old, whether it's Space Force, cutting edge on Space Force, where many people thought, well, we don't need that. Now we know for sure we need that. Whether it's hitting it off with a young inventor, Elon Musk, who's guy's in his 40s, you would think, well, there's going to be an age gap. They're best buddies. And then you go, hey, crypto, that's something new. Let me learn about it. And what I don't know, I put somebody in charge of it. And that's made crypto, by the way, go through the roof. Oil and gas, XL pipeline, get the ratchet set ready. They are going to start putting that together again. So that's going to start working from Canada to Texas.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I think we all know that precedent by a court doesn't matter anymore in this country, and people violate laws anytime they want. So for me, if I violate this law, it's because I want a court to pay attention to it.
Yeah, not the best line in the world. It could get her in legal trouble. That is a election worker who basically admits, and I'm going to count votes that are corrupted, not signed, problems with them, not acceptable, because you could sue me and then decide where the chips will fall where they may. What am I talking about? I'm talking about an election that is now being recounted for the Senate seat in Pennsylvania, where there was a ton of problems in 2020, you may remember. And just lately, the governor weighs in. That election worker under additional scrutiny, and you'll hear their follow-up teary remarks in a moment. But first, let me bring in my next guest, Michael Whatley, RNC chair. Michael, welcome back.
It's great to be on with you, sir.
I can't believe we're still waiting for it to be official and for Dave McCormick to be the next senator from Pennsylvania. But that election worker's statements alarm so many people in this country. I imagine you were one of them.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's that somebody finally said the quiet part out loud. We have known that there are election officials across the country that are going to bend the rules to help Democrats. We've always seen it. That's why we built the first ever National Election Integrity Program here at the RNC to go and fight instances like this. And when she said that on the record, I think everybody did a double take, and it just confirms what a lot of people have always suspected. And it's absolutely inappropriate. You know, we had John Fetterman come out and say, well, it's only a few hundred votes. You know what? Every vote counts. And it really, truly matters. Bob Casey, you know, is absolutely trashing his own legacy as he walks out the door as an election denier. You know, we did not need to go through this recount. We know what the result is going to be, yet he's, you know, continuing to push to have these ballots counted when they're clearly illegal, says the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And now we have Josh Shapiro very, very late to the game, I guess better late than never, saying that the county should actually obey the law. You know, it is surprising to me that a man who wants to be a leader in that state would allow this type of activity to move forward over a couple of weeks before he finally weighs in and says, hey, please follow the law.
So, by the way, she realized that you guys were thought about legal action against her. She realizes how much trouble she's in and what she caused. Here she is apologizing. Diane Ellis Marshagalia, cut 25.
It was my poor choice of words. They did get clipped. They were out of context, and they have been shown over. They have been shown over and over and over again on social media, national media. And I have literally been contacted by hundreds of people. I apologize profusely to the employees of this county and to the people who were called in my name because all of that rage was directed at me. But I remind you all that we all say things that are out of turn. We all make mistakes. I made a mistake. And because I am an elected official, I am held to a far higher standard than everybody else.
Is that good enough for you?
Well, look, she did make a mistake. She admitted on the air that she was going to cast a vote that she knew was to include illegal ballots. She cast that vote, and they moved forward to count those ballots. There needs to be accountability here. You know, this is something that you can't look the other way. And again, even if it's only over a few hundred votes, you need to move aggressively on this, which is why we have. And I expect that long term there need to be consequences in more of these cases around the country. I mean, I'm all about accepting an apology, but, you know, things like this cannot happen again. And in Pennsylvania, we want to serve notice to everybody. And we've said it throughout the course of this campaign. If you cheat or you help others cheat, we will prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law. And we will absolutely do everything we can to make sure that there's accountability here.
I just want you to hear the people of Bucks County went crazy, too. Cut 27.
How can the American people believe in the integrity of this election when these commissioners promise to disregard and break the law? The answer is they cannot. These are elected officials who openly and blatantly admitted to disobeying the law. How could we ever have faith in their ability to uphold the law again? The answer is we cannot. And they must resign immediately.
We're sick and tired of one side facing consequences for actions. Where are the consequences for your actions?
So, I mean, they're doing a lot of your fighting, but that's the frustration. We don't care. You know, everybody wants their person to win. We just want to know what's fair. Do you think, from what you know, I know you like the outcome of this election, 53 Senate seats, the majority in the House. But the slim majorities and could have been bigger in the Senate, I guess, and the House is very slim again. Do you think it was a free and fair election? Do you feel good about most of the states?
We feel significantly better about this election cycle than we did coming out of 2020. And I think that what we have done now is proven that if you're in the room when the votes are being cast and you're in the room when the votes are being counted, you can have a big impact in ensuring that we're going to have a fair, accurate, secure, and transparent election. I think the transparency is absolutely critical. You know, now we've got situations like in California where we're still voting or still counting votes, excuse me, you know, because state law allows those votes to come in 7 days after the election is actually over. We are in court right now trying to prevent that from happening again, you know, but, you know, we're you know, got a couple of very, very close elections where I have officials, I have lawyers, I have observers that we are all over it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, here we are 15 days after the election and we still don't have a count done in California. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make sure that we have the right rules of the road in place. And as we gear up for 26, that's going to be a huge focus for us at the RNC.
Michael, do you right now you're at 219 in the House. Is that correct? Because you took the Alaska seat?
Yes, sir.
All right, you're at 219 in the House. How many elections are still out there? Do you know?
The only two that I'm fully aware of right now that we're tracking are in California. We're going to be within hundreds of votes on those two races out there. You know, so this is going to be a Republican majority. It is going to be a very, very, very narrow Republican majority. You know, we've got 53 in the Senate. And, you know, the key for us in Congress, and I've been meeting, you know, with the House leadership and Senate leadership teams over the course of the week, really is going to come down to moving forward with President Trump's agenda and making sure that you go before the voters with a record of actually getting things done.
Michael Whatley, our guest. So, Michael, one of the people that helped you bring all the success for the Republicans is Lara Trump. And she basically said, when asked, would you like to fill Marco Rubio's seat when he goes to become Secretary of State, which everyone agrees he's going to get confirmed? She said, yeah, she's interested in talking about it. Do you think, would she have your vote to be somebody that would be a good pick for Governor DeSantis?
Well, I think Laura Trump would be a great senator. I think she has been an absolutely fantastic co-chair here at the RNC, and she's going to be fantastic at whatever she does over the course of her life and her career. She is a absolutely very smart, very driven woman. She's a great mother. She's a great wife and truly an asset for this entire country.
Do you think the governor will call you and ask your opinion?
I don't know if he will call me or not, but I could not sing Laura's praises high enough for the work that she has done. And I've known her since we met in 2016, working on the president's campaign. And she is absolutely the epitome of class and intelligence, mm-hmm, and hard work.
So she'd have you. So you would not be against her doing that. So I understand you probably want the governor to make his own decision. I can't imagine if she's available, there'd be someone better. Now, what have you told the president's team or suggested to the president's team about taking any more House members? You know, you've taken Gates, Stefanik, and you have Michael Waltz are now elected but not serving. They got to be replaced because there's got to be special elections. Can you have another? Can you lose another?
Yeah, look, we're tracking very, very closely to make sure that any of the picks are not going to overturn the Republican majority in the House. And I think that there will probably have to be some sequencing of when these folks are going to go in. We've already had Matt Gaetz, you know, step down. So that has created one opening in Florida. You know, we know that Governor DeSantis has to set the special election there for that to get filled. And then we're going to kind of have to make sure that we walk these other positions out in a way that is not going to tip the House over to the Democrats.
Right. So, in other words, Byron Donalds, who might be a favorite for that position, you just can't afford to lose him.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I know that everybody is keenly aware of the narrow margin. I spoke with House leadership yesterday and today, and everybody is being very careful to track, you know, where we are on this stuff. The president is very, very aware, and so, you know, what we want to make sure that we're doing is stocking his cabinet and his administration with the best talent available. At the same time, making sure that we're in a working relationship and able to work with majorities in the House and the Senate.
Michael, I tell you, everyone's ready to give up on polling, you know, from the outsider perspective, because they're too close to call. This person's up. Iowa, you I guess that you guys were losing in Iowa. You never were losing in Iowa, and you won every battleground state. But internally, with what you do, were you surprised by the margin of victory, now that you can be candid and we're not in an election cycle, about the polling? Are you ready to give up on polling, or do you guys have such a sophisticated polling method that you still feel as though you have an indication of how these elections are going to go before the votes are counted?
Yeah, I would have to say, and Tony Fabrizio, who served as our pollster, Chris LaCivita, who was the campaign manager and my chief of staff, the work that they did, we were very, very accurate in terms of understanding where the electorate was, where the polls were. Our polls turned out to be extraordinarily accurate, and they really down the stretch helped us because we knew these are the states where we need to spend a little bit more time with presidential rallies. These are the states that we feel comfortable with, so maybe we'll not necessarily have to send the president there one more time. Where are we going to send the extra TV commercials? Where are we going to send the extra digital commercials? Where was J.D. Vance going to be deployed? And I will tell you, from the work that we saw with Tony Fabrizio and his team, remarkably on point, and really helped shape our campaign down the stretch.
What was with the move to New Mexico and New Hampshire late? What did you see? Was that a head fake?
No, I think with New Mexico, we were seeing that there was a move, that it was tightening, that it was close. And we also were planning on having the president in Arizona and Nevada. So it's just a matter of dropping in and doing a rally while he was on that swing. You know, for New Hampshire, we saw a couple different polls that indicated that it was tightening up, a couple other polls that didn't. We thought that it was worth the investment of having J.D. Vance go up there and do an event. But what the president was focused on was the key seven battleground states. And you continually saw him and J.D. Vance, myself, Laura Trump, and the rest of the establishment in Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania over the course of the last 2 to 3 weeks.
Are you staying on as RNC chair?
That is my intent, yes. I will be facing reelection in January, but the president and I have had a conversation, and I am willing to stay on and serve.
So if I can look ahead, we know the advantage that you had, and we see everyone from Bill Maher to Charles Barkley look back, and to, I'm even watching so many people look back and say, you know, why, you know, ignoring the going back to the pronouns and ignoring women in men and women's sports, and ignoring the border, all those things on oil and gas, and ignoring inflation, saying it's transitory. You know the mistakes they made. How do you solidify the gains you made? Being that you don't really have time to celebrate, it's time to make sure the midterms solidify the Republicans' momentum. How do you make sure of that?
Yeah, the president ran and won on a common sense agenda. You know, he really talked in every single rally about restoring the southern border, rebuilding our economy, ensuring America is strong enough to protect our interests and allies, and keeping our communities safe. He built a common sense coalition that included RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard and Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy and folks from all across the political spectrum, and communicated directly with the American voters about a common sense agenda. We now have a common sense mandate. And so what we need is for the Senate to confirm the president's nominees, and we need to get them in place to be able to implement this agenda. And then we need to see the wins in the House and the Senate in order to go to the American people in 26. But, you know, this is not an extremist agenda. This is an agenda that is backed by the vast majority of the American people. And that's why we saw an Electoral College landslide with 312 votes.
Have you ever seen the president-elect happier?
I got to tell you, it has been fantastic to spend some time with him over the last couple of weeks. He is ready to go. You can see that he has already rolled up his sleeves. He's meeting with the transition team. He's choosing his cabinet officers, and he is very ready to start having an impact and getting America out of this ditch and getting us back on the road to strength and prosperity. Yeah,
he's certainly got a lot to do. Michael Whatley, thanks so much. Congratulations to you. You had so much to do with this success. Michael Whatley, appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Brian.
Go get him. Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Just a lot going on today. Pete Hegseth in the building, meeting with some senators yesterday. Matt Gaetz is going to have an uphill battle. I don't care if you're the biggest Matt Gaetz fan, and there are some, and the biggest detractor. Let's just look at the numbers. He's got 2 months to win over Susan Collins, 2 months to win over Lisa Murkowski, 2 months to win over Senator Mitch McConnell. I don't think any of them are moving, so you can only lose one more. I mean, is Senator Grassley chairman of the judiciary? You can't use leverage really over a senator that's 92 and not running again. So those are votes of votes, and not one Democrat's going to vote for him. You could just mark my words. There's no even Joe Manchin who might have an affinity for him. I'm not even talking about the ethics charge. I'm talking about his performance in the House. What makes you think that he is worthy of being attorney general from what he's done in the House? When he sits down and talks to these senators, he's got to say, yeah, that was me in the House. That's what my constituents wanted me to do. But when I'm an attorney general, this is what I'm going to do. And this is what I'm capable of. And this is what I've done legally in the past. And this is my knowledge of the position. And here's the person, the AG, I almost look up to. And answer the question that every Democrat's going to ask. You're just going to be the personal attorney of President Trump. I think for President Trump to pick Matt Gaetz because he likes him. Okay, got it. But he's also extremely worn out. He's worn out for 2.5 years of cases. He's worn out for 4 years of his Justice Department turning on him. And no one really cracking down on them until William Barr got in there.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Appreciate you being there, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. We're watching the Danny Penny trial closely. The defense is up there going to bat for a guy that they are desperate to find something wrong with, but they can't. A Marine that surfs when it's free time, plays in a symphony when he's not doing that. And as you hear him describe the story, you'd hope to have him around you anytime you might be in trouble. Contrast that with the ridiculous trial they put Trump through, with the rampant crime that's happening here. And the stabbing of three people by a psychotic lunatic who stabbed these people in a beautiful part of Manhattan simply because they were distracted. This hour, we're going to be joined by Chris Myers, author of a brand new book about his fantastic sports career. Mark Halperin standing by. So, Mark, let's get right to you. As a political analyst, best-selling author, having huge success with your YouTube show. Great to hear from you.
Brian, nice to be back on with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I mean, during this whole election, it seems to me like you really enjoyed being straight down the middle. And you were able to ride no one's wave, no one momentum, but point out who was on a roll and who wasn't. When Trump was flailing, when he wasn't. When the interpretation might be different from the reality. Why do you think you were able to do that? And the result really shows that you were right, especially in the backstretch.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, the three things quick. I've done it my whole career. I've always just felt I should be a straight journalist, not a partisan. And as you know, that's not all that common anymore. Two is I always had sources in both parties, and I did this cycle, including connected to the campaigns and the super PACs, but also independent analysts with a lot of access to data. And finally, the platform I'm on now that you mentioned, Two-Way, we bring in regular Americans from across the country, and we have Trump supporters and Harris supporters and Biden supporters and Kennedy supporters and Musk supporters, and those voices were never wrong. They weren't always singing the same song, but if you listen to them in totality over the course of the last few months, they kept all of us real honest about what the country was thinking, and no one who was on my platform was surprised at the outcome.
Here's the one thing different that we're always going to remember in this era, and I don't think it's going to be replicated. So, you know, Romney loses to Obama, okay. McCain loses to Obama, all right, this is the result, and, you know, whether someone took it bad or ran a bad campaign, one thing or the other. But I never remember a time, and it's happened now for three straight cycles, where Donald Trump was living. Not only did people not want him, they said he was going to destroy the country, called him Hitler, a fascist. Now, Trump uses those type of words in rhetoric, but people got the impression that Trump was going to end the world. And when he wins and he goes to the White House and they shake hands and say, Donald, I'm here to help you, a lot of people got freaked out. Were caught by surprise. Why do you think that is?
You know, I really pleaded with everyone I knew who was a never Trumper, someone with Trump derangement syndrome or super opposed to Donald Trump. I said, he's going to get 47% of the vote, and he might get 50. But the difference between 47 and 50 is, you know, several million Americans. You have to respect the fact that tens of millions of people are going to vote for him, and you have to be prepared for that. And some people listened to me, but most of them didn't. There's something about Donald Trump that sets them off. Now, he brings a lot of it on himself through his behavior, through his rhetoric, through his conduct. But it goes beyond that. And of course, it's particularly exacerbated by what I call the dominant media, which creates this fantasy world of Joe Biden doesn't have an acuity problem. Kamala Harris should be given the nomination without any question. The open border is not an issue that people really care about. All these things. The prosecutions of Donald Trump, the attempts to keep him off the ballot.
Trans athletes in sports.
The attempts to keep Bobby Kennedy off the ballot. All of these things. The failure of the president, the vice president, to express outrage at the murder of American citizens by people in the country illegally. All these things add up to a blue bubble that they just can't see. I see this all the time. I'll say to a Trump supporter, why does the left not like Donald Trump? And they can explain it. Very easily, why people would not like Donald Trump. And some of them feel the same way, but they still think he'd be a better president than Kamala Harris. But most people on the left, if you say, why do people like Donald Trump? They're paralyzed. They can't answer the question. And the litany you and I just did together is a big part of the explanation. It's not the whole thing, but it's a big part of it. And they just, for some reason, they can't appreciate that tens of millions of their fellow countrymen and women feel differently than they do.
And the thing is, what made it personal is that people were dismissive of those who did follow him, like they had mental acuity issues. You know, There's something wrong with them. And when the words comes out like garbage or the basket of deplorables, it made it us against them. And was there enough us to beat them? And when there
100%,
was, people freaked out. And among them, I listened to Jon Stewart. I don't care if he rips me tomorrow. He's so talented. But I wanted to see how he would take this and listen to this.
Meanwhile, Joe and Mika Brzezinski-Scarborough, who famously warned of the growing threat of Trump's fascism, also had an interesting announcement to make.
Joe and I went to Mar-a-Lago to meet personally with President-elect Trump. And for those asking why we would go speak to the president-elect during such fraught times, especially between us, I guess I would ask back, why wouldn't we?
Because you said he was Hitler.
And what's the result? I mean, his response is similar to what you just talked about. What's the result of what they did, what they did?
Well, they're longtime friends of mine, and so I'll speak more generally rather than just them. I think everybody on the left should be asking the question, why wouldn't people want to be interested in Trump and Trump supporters before the election? To wait till after the election, I think for a lot of people looks like it's opportunistic or for ratings or for some other reason. I think everyone who's in the camp of having strongly opposed Donald Trump, of saying he was Hitler, saying he was a fascist, or denigrating the people who would support him. They should ask themselves, why? Where was this attitude before the election? Because to do it now is quite a different thing.
True. I listened to Charlemagne the God, who I've interviewed when he did his book tour, and he would just casually say to me, oh, Brian, he's never going to get elected as a convicted felon. I go, Charlemagne, do you look at this case? I mean, you have legal experts, and you have other people like Governor Cuomo, who says this wouldn't be tried without him. But he said, Brian, he's a convicted felon. He's never going to get elected. And this is what he said a couple of days ago.
Hey, mm-hmm. New York City, just throw the whole thing away.
I don't understand why they're playing with that, man.
Cut it out.
Just stop it. We're going to wait 4 years.
Who we fooling?
Yeah, leave it alone.
Nothing's going to happen to Trump. And nobody, you know, wants the nobody wants that retribution that he made deliver hanging over their head. He won the election. It is what it is.
In May, when that came out, you had President Biden saying, yeah, I know you're off on Wednesdays during his trial. Let's debate then. And making comments like that. Now we're at the point where everyone's like, well, that case, it should really go away. And most people looked at that case and can't believe they're going to hold it for 4 years. What about the case, the impact of that case, the reaction now and the reaction on, and its impact on the campaign?
I think two of the things that you would think would have helped the Democrats the most played a massive role in electing Donald Trump. One is the prosecutions, which weren't meritless. It wasn't like they were made up, but they were novel cases brought late in the contest in a way that would not have been brought against someone else. And then the media bias media coverage. You would think those two things would help to convict him, to indict him, to spread the word that he's a felon, an indicted person, or all the negative coverage, overwhelmingly negative. But I think from talking to voters, both those things helped Donald Trump, because a lot of voters could see what I don't know if liberals see it or not, but certainly some independent analysts see it, particularly in the legal front. Those two things weren't right. They're not the way the system's supposed to work. And I think a lot of people held their nose and voted for Donald Trump because they said, and I know this again from my two-way platform, people would come on and say, I just can't possibly reward the Democrats for lawfare and for the bias coverage. I have to vote for Donald Trump because what's happening is just not right.
So, Mark, I don't know if you remember, it seems like 10 years ago, but during the primary process, that's when these court cases was going, the New York case was going, the indictments, the mugshots. And I remember Governor DeSantis saying, you know, I'm over here and walking through the fields of Iowa. No one's even paying attention. When Donald Trump comes, all my questions about Donald Trump and his trials. So it actually worked. They wanted to destroy him perhaps before he got the nomination, or weaken him when he got it, it would be useless. And it really frustrated most of the field that he didn't debate, number one, and number two, that the trial swamped them. And that wasn't Trump's fault.
It certainly helped him win the nomination, not just in raising money and dominating the news, but in rallying people around him to say, we can't possibly let the Democrats pick our nominee. And then the general, I'm sure it hurt him in some ways, but I think net it helped him for the reasons I said. And it's just so unfortunate. It's just such a bizarre thing for the Democrats to say, now we're worried that Donald Trump will use the Justice Department to go after his political enemies. It would say it with no sense of self-consciousness. What happened on January 6th bothers a lot of people and was wrong. Donald Trump's failure to acknowledge that he lost the election, even though there were things that happened in the election related to COVID that shouldn't have happened, to convince so many people the election was rigged, that's wrong. He does other things that are wrong. But the people on the other side don't seem to understand that it's not zero sum. It's not like Donald Trump's the only one who's done things wrong in the last 4 years. And again, I think that's a big part of why he was able to win.
Do you think coverage will be different? I already see Trump being different. Yeah, I mean, fights he's just avoided having when these governors coming together to say we're going to be Trump-proof. And normally he'd be on every single one of them. And let me ask, do you think the coverage will be different? There's no Russia investigation. There's nobody saying he's illegitimate. There's nobody saying they didn't win the popular vote. There's no one challenging election results.
Yep.
So do you think they'll cover him more like they do Obama, Bush, and Clinton?
Yeah, I think so far the coverage, the tone of the coverage is muted. It's not as negative as it's been, but they've got to figure out what they want to do. And to me, and I've said this before, until they acknowledge their role in the conspiracy to cover up Joe Biden's mental acuity decline, it's hard to take them seriously in terms of being introspective until they acknowledge all the ways for the last 4 years they tried to get Joe Biden reelected and then to get Kamala Harris elected. It's hard to imagine that they're really going to change or to take any efforts to change seriously. It's hard for them to change because their economic models are tied to people who want anti-Trump coverage. If they have the courage to say we're actually be really interested in holding him accountable, tough coverage, but not unfair coverage. You know, I'll just give another example that I know you know. They allowed the vice president throughout her campaign to say Donald Trump said good people on both sides. Donald Trump said bloodbath. Donald Trump said dictator on day one. Those are all just patently false. And those were centerpieces of Democratic rhetoric and her rhetoric during the campaign. Until they acknowledge that they call that every little thing, everything Donald Trump says fact-checked. And again, he lies all the time, and the real lies should be called out. But until they acknowledge that the centerpiece of her campaign was three fundamental lies about Donald Trump, it's just hard to imagine that people who doubt their fairness can take them seriously.
True. I'm very, very curious to the nomination process and political capital. I actually don't think Donald Trump spending political capital on controversial picks and nominations. I feel like Trump's Trump. Those are his selections. If they go down, he'll pick somebody else. Where I do feel with other
totally
presidents
agree.
That they do. Oh, my goodness. You know, the person had a nanny problem. They're this is going to be really bad for George H.W. Bush. And I just don't see it. I think they'll just say if Gates fails or RFK fails, they'll say we'll pick somebody else and it will be on them. I just think that, and I think most people realize that. So the question now is, what happens to Democrats? Jen Psaki said this about who leads the party from here.
Look, I think Democrats are in the wilderness, as you just said before. There is no clear leader of the party. Ooh. Joe Biden is going to be out of office shortly. Kamala Harris just lost the election. There are a lot of governors and other people who might emerge, maybe people we don't know about yet.
Right.
But there is no clear leader of the party right now.
Is that typical after an election loss?
It is. What's a little different is the three things. First, there's no agreement about why she lost. Her top aides did an interview with the Washington Post in which I think they avoided all the real reasons why she lost, and they said the race was unwinnable. So until there's an agreement about why they lost the election, I think that they're in trouble, and that's different. Usually there's a pretty clear consensus. Second is, when they've come back in the past, there have been some once-in-a-generation politicians out there, Clinton and Obama in particular, Bill Clinton. I don't really see anybody like that right now. And then three, the party is further to the left than it's been in our lifetime. And so to the extent some people in the party believe that they need to come more back to the center, they got a long way to go and a lot of very influential liberals to suppress, to take the power back from. So this is a pretty dire situation. Now, what they do have going for them is Donald Trump's a lame duck. You know, it's a second term and he can't run again. And so the Republicans are going to have their own issues with that. But I'll be curious to see who they elect as party chair. Some people think it's not a big deal. Others think it is. I think if they pick a strong person, it can be a big deal. But it's difficult. There are no obvious leaders in Congress. I think the governors that they have are overrated as national leaders in terms of their willingness to do what's necessary to really seize the megaphone from a state capitol. So it's not the worst situation I've seen a party in after mm-hmm. a presidential loss, but it's pretty close to it.
How do we get your two-way platform? How do people, my listeners, watch you?
You can go on my Substack or my X account, or just go to twoway.tv and sign up. And we're doing shows now every day, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern time. And they're free. Just log on to YouTube and you can watch them, or come on the two-way platform. You can ask a question. And we have political leaders and strategists on, but it's really a platform for regular folks to just get a chance to weigh in and ask questions.
And on FoxNews.com, Mark talks about the four people who helped drive Donald Trump's GOAT comeback, greatest of all time. Mark, thanks so much. Hope we do this again.
Brian, great to be on with you. Thanks.
Back in a moment.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, I went a little long with Mark, but it's just so great. This, his perspective on things and his access to both sides, I think, is invaluable. The other guy I really like, too, and you probably see him on CNN. I watch him. The only show that I always would love to watch on CNN is Michael Smirkanish. I think he's the same way. You know, he used to work for Bush, but I don't think he's dug in, but doesn't hate Trump. I think that's those are rare qualities these days. And we don't even know what's going to happen. I'm sure you all saw the story about MSNBC and CNBC being for sale. NBC's spinning them out, and maybe they're just spinning their wheels. And if you have seen CNN's ratings, look, we all go up and down. Shows get hot and get cold. I don't wish anything bad on anyone in the industry. I just want to, I want Fox to be successful. You want to win, except for certain people. But they're getting low numbers, like 1980 numbers. Like your 8 o'clock show is getting a 0.5. When you have Larry King was getting like a 3.0 or 2.5 during his day. So when you put all this money into all this talent and they just live off being anti-Trump and everyone just says, okay, you do that, I'm not watching, and you do that and I'm selling the station, I think you should get the message. Not that Trump walks on water. No one says he is. But we just give him a fair shot every day and we actually think his intentions are right.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Are you capable of killing somebody?
You know, I would say, actually, I would say no, even though I'm sure if someone was presenting some imminent danger to my kids or something, I'm sure everybody would be
capable. Would you kill for Nicole?
If I thought someone was going to hurt her, to protect the people you love. I mean, we dropped a bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I think most Americans supported that, even though we may, in retrospect, think about the lives that we took. But I think most people, to protect their home and their families, would do that.
Oh, wow. That was an interesting analogy, an interesting interview. We all remember we were glued to it, the first live interview of O.J. Simpson after he was exonerated from killing his wife, which we all know he did. The person who did that interview joins me right now. He is Chris Myers of Fox, author of a brand new book, That Deserves a Wow, Untold Stories of Legends and Champions, Their Wins and Heartbreaks. Chris Myers, welcome. Congratulations on the book. It's excellent.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Boy, that brought back some chilling memories listening to O.J. spin his story.
I mean, just to set us up, if you would, Chris. This is one of the moments that everyone remembers up close with Roy Firestone. You took over for him on that interview show. It was time for athletes to open up, and you did a great job doing that. And when O.J. Simpson said, hey, I'm going to do a live interview, live only, you stepped into there, and you got the interview. And you said you were nervous for this.
Yes, because everybody warned me that he could spin and make you look stupid. He knew the truth better than anybody, and he was good at framing the facts the way he saw them. Of course, we all watched the trial, but there was evidence we didn't see, and he never took the stand in the murder trial. Now, the wrongful death suit, that was a slam dunk. He was guilty, found and liable and owed the money, which he never really paid. But I studied in the time that I had, and some people said I shouldn't do the interview. They were angry, saying it's a sports interview show, you're putting a killer on the air, and you're going to glorify him about his playing days. And that was never our intention, and I told Simpson and his rep that coming on the show that, hey, I got to ask anything I want. And his only condition was it was live and you couldn't ask about my children. And I thought that was fair, but I had plenty of notes and information. And I was worried maybe he wouldn't show up, but he had watched the show with athletes on it and said, hey, he thought I was fair. And so I had him on, and it was supposed to be a 30-minute live show. We ended up going, 50 or 40-something with commercials. And I mean, my idea was, Brian, to ask the questions that we all would have asked had he been on the stand, and at least mm-hmm. the people were talking about years later, and see how he would answer it. And he was truly in denial. But also what struck me in the book, a little bit of background, is how detached he was from the reality of things, even in the commercial. And he was the only guest I never shook his hand. I didn't want to be rude, but I also just couldn't accept the fact.
What did he try to talk to you about in the commercial, Chris?
Well, we're showing pictures of his wife getting beat up and some talking about her being murdered, or his ex-wife in this case, and live for the first 7 or 8 minutes. And then we hit the break, And he turns to me and says something like, I got an extra, we got a tee time at Riviera Country Club to play some golf next week. We got an opening if you want to join us. I mean, it's not like I'm pals with a guy, right? So I was stunned by this. And then this PR rep comes running out of the green room, this woman who's yelling, hey, you can't ask these questions. You shouldn't be. And he was like, no, go back in there. I got this. This is fine, you know, kind of a thing. So that's how awkward it felt. But I wasn't intimidated by him.
Right.
I just wanted to do the best job I could.
I just want you people at home to remember this, or maybe for the first time hear it. Here's a little bit more. Cut 38.
It doesn't look like you're consumed with finding the real killer. Somebody murdered someone you love so much.
Well, I can only do what I can do. I wouldn't you think that Fred Goldman or anybody, they think I did.
Well, but, he did. He was consumed, and his justice
was the same trial. There's many, many people out here been murdered. I've seen friends of Ron Goldman get their throats cut. They haven't found who did it. Who's looking for him?
You know,
friends of Ron's have been shot a year after he was murdered.
You know friends of Ron Goldman.
You ever hear a guy named Cantor? You ever hear a guy named Michael Nick? These are people who were around him in his
house
who have been murdered. Because of people. Because of investigators. I got people out there, and every time we get information, we put there are people around this person in his life that has been murdered before, a person that he started doing various things that this guy Cantor was doing. He kind of took up from him. Who has had his throat cut, murdered. The police don't know who did it.
Crazy, right?
Right. You know, just deflecting everything, never really trying to answer that. And I asked him further on, could he name a detective or show us a canceled check or a bill or reference a private eye that he really was seeking out or talked to about finding the real killers because they weren't on a golf course. And of course, he didn't come. He spun some other excuse, but could never show or prove anything.
So, Chris, one thing to take away from here, from reading your book, and we'll get to some great moments, but just for you, you wanted to be a part of sports, but you were never a great athlete, so you thought this was going to be the way. You've always just liked communicating. You always like conversation. You care more about the athletes than you do the game. You can keep your box score. Tell me about the people, right?
Yes, exactly. Maybe it's how I'm brought up in a big family and priorities of relating to people, even in difficult situations, and fascinated by how people responded to things, whether it was humor or stress or success. As a kid, there's different layers of that. But then watching sports, I saw this on a grand stage, and it consumed me. So I was always interested in, I love sports and the final score, but you know what it took to get there, how they handled defeat and those types of things. And through three or four decades, from 10 years at ESPN and 20 plus years at Fox Sports and local sports and local radio, which was so much fun, I met so many different personalities and learned a lot from all of them. And it kind of, you know, sports reflects a lot of our lives. It mirrors a lot of our lives in a lot of ways. And I've seen that since I was a kid, and I still see it now calling games.
The one thing, too, is you always had a perspective and a love of country. Your dad was in on the D-Day invasion. How did that shape him and your family?
Yeah, he grew up during the Depression, and I reference him because he was such a hardworking, old school, as a teenager, enlisted right away after Pearl Harbor, was on a ship and hit the shore, and D-Day survived that, lived into his 80s before passing away, but every year would go back for different reunions, and just impressed upon us as kids to appreciate your country, to be, if they need you, be ready, but be thankful that you're not in wars right now, because it was a very difficult thing. He didn't get into a lot of the details in that, but it shaped our entire family to respect, to be grateful that the country we're in, and to treat it with respect. And that's why a national anthem, every time it plays as a sporting event, it hits me. It really means, it never gets old, whether it's a Little League game or a Super Bowl game. And when I went to see the movie Private Ryan with him at that, you remember that specifically D-Day, he couldn't handle the first 2 or 3 minutes because of how realistic that was. He saw Marines fall in the water and the bullets, the sound they made hitting the water. So it was something that was tough for him. But later he would open up a little bit about what he saw and was grateful to survive it, and also was always remembering those who didn't come back.
Yeah, I mean, so the other thing to keep in mind is when someone lives his life so serious and so blue collar, and you say, hey, I want to be a sportscaster, sometimes there might be pushback. Nobody makes a living like that. You know, go ahead and get a real job. Or were they totally supportive of you from day one? I know at 16 you're working at a radio station, which is almost unheard of, and you had a passion for it. But was there any pushback from more traditional parents like you had?
Yeah, well, I would say they weren't anti-sports, but they didn't emphasize it. It was more like, hey, get good grades, be involved in the community, read about what's going on in the world, and be up on politics, and so you can make up your own mind. I said, Dad, I'm 10. Relax here. It was kind of that. He worked two jobs, but it's funny, Brian. I would tell him, I would say, hey, I'm worried about the Dodgers going to win the World Series. He would say, son, you you should be up on the news and who's running for office, and then later when I got a career in this. And of course, he saw the success from it, and I would call him and say, hey, Dad, what do you think of this recent election? He'd say, never mind that. How about those Yankees? They're having problems again. So it switched a little bit, but he accepted it later, and I appreciate it because what he did instill was a hard work ethic and an open mind, as long as you were informed.
Was that one of the best things that they could say from being on TV, where your parents could be proud of you and point to different events you did and tell family and friends what you're doing and maybe bring them to some of these games?
Yes, I was able to bring my father to a charity golf event where a number of athletes, were, and they treated him so great, especially when they appreciated his time in service. And so it was more a way of kind of rewarding them in any way that I could for them. Again, I had two brothers, two sisters, so there was a lot for them to do, and didn't have a lot of money during those times. But yeah, that and it wasn't so much to brag, hey, he's on TV. It was like, you worked hard, you went in the direction you did. Follow your passion. And something else he would say, it was follow your talent is what he told me too. And my mom, they're both, because passion is one thing, but you got to have some talent to help that passion, fuel that to make it work. And that stuck with me.
And you asked for an air conditioner and you sat under their air conditioner and you believe you got that resonating voice as a young guy that got you these jobs because you sat under that air conditioner. Is that true?
Yeah,
or is that just a theory that Chris Myers has?
Well, it was a theory that I had as a kid because that's what my family told me. And even the doctor was like, well, it's causing a little bit of a nasal drip and his voice is changing sooner than we would expect. Or maybe he just had this voice. I don't know. But yeah, I shared, bunk beds. There were three brothers in one room. And so my older and younger brother, they didn't like it as cold. We're growing up in the heat of South Florida at night. So I finally get a wall air conditioner and I had to aim the vents right at where I was sleeping so that it would be, I piled up blankets, wanted it cold at night. And I would wake up with this, and over time the voice developed in a few. And this is before I ever called into the radio station and got on the radio, and then later, and that was my real voice. So that's the, I wouldn't recommend it, but that's the theory. Right? Just so you know,
the guy that wrote I'm going to go with it, Chris. I'll be the second source.
okay, good.
So the guy who wrote the forward to your book to everybody in my era knows because of Stripes and because of Caddyshack, and it's Bill Murray, of course, SNL first. And he just likes you. And he came home with you one day. He surprised your wife. You guys are buddies. Here's Bill Murray on Up Close, Cut 39.
Tell us about Harry Carey and sitting at Wrigley Field, why that is so special.
Well, it's a great place. Harry Carey behaves like a fan. That's why he's such a good broadcaster, because he goes, oh, God, he should have had it, choker. He just announces like a fan should, and people go, can speak in harmony with that.
Baseball needs a commissioner. Who'd be a good one?
I don't know. My friend Mike Vec at St. Paul Saints said the reason they cremated his father, Bill Vec, was so that he wouldn't be flipping over in his grave when he heard Bud Selig was the commissioner.
Wow.
I like that one.
That deserves a wow.
Yeah.
And
who should be a commissioner?
Yeah.
I don't know.
We got about 30 seconds.
Probably not Peter Gammons, though.
Why not?
He should go into public service.
Funny guy, right? Is he? What's he like to hang out with, Chris?
Oh, yeah. He's just, you never know what's coming. And he is a very, people have seen him as a diehard Cub fan, but a Chicago sports fan, but he's a very astute sports fan. You can sit and watch a golf match or something, and his observations that are serious and related to the sport. But then he's always funny. That one of the first times I met him, I was in New York working, and I had an off day in Manhattan. I didn't have a car, and he had his place up on the Hudson River there. And he said, why don't you come over? I said, I don't have a car. So I'll send a car for you, and just, we can hang out for the day before you have to go back to work the next day. So he sends this gigantic white stretch limo that picks me up in Manhattan. And as I'm driving into his driveway, he's videotaping me stepping out of the car with the limo. And he says, hey, this is how Chris spends your company's per diem. Okay, I just want you to know. And so right away, I knew that I was in for a lot of fun with him. But he's got it in the book. I talk about a lot of fun moments. But also, Brian, there's a very sensitive, tender side of him where he is. You see the family, caring, loving part. He also recommended, when I was hesitant about doing the OJ interview, he said, you got to do it. And he recommended a book for me about how to talk to your children so they'll listen, and how to listen so your children will talk to you. And it was basically so I could, how I could handle, you know, an O.J. Simpson spinning stories and that type of thing. So, yeah, there's a lot more to Bill Murray that we see on the screen. But I'm just grateful for the years and to get to know him and his brothers and other, again, gigantic family. They're a fun group, a creative group of people.
So lastly, a great moment. I was at that game, too, but you were covering it. Tom Brady mounts the greatest comeback, I think, in NFL history. Wins in overtimes, beat the Falcons 34-28. You got the interview with the quarterback. Cut 40.
Tom, can you just talk about what you were thinking and how you brought the team back when you were down 25?
We all brought each other back. So we were never felt out of it. It was a tough battle. But they have a great team. I give them a lot of credit. We just made a few more plays than them.
I mean, you're fifth. They're all sweet, but this is incredible. First overtime, the way you came back. Is the most recent one the best?
They're all great. You know, I think this team resembled a lot of teams from the past that had a lot of mental toughness, great defense. Everyone rose to the occasion in the second half and overtime.
And you said you're not motivated by the past, but a little redemption maybe in this moment?
This is all positive, man. This is unbelievable. I'm going to go see my family.
So that's good. I mean, that obviously, if he wanted to talk, he won. You also talk about when Bill Belichick didn't and he lost to the Giants. So you're great at that, Chris. Are you the proudest of your sideline work or the play-by-play?
Yeah, well, I mean, I started on the sidelines, and I think there's a value to that, Brian, from doing that and then being up in the broadcast booth. You do so much hard work down on the field, and only a certain percentage, maybe 10-15%, goes on the air because that's all that's needed. I mean, the game is the thing. And that was funny with Brady. You know, that was because it was the overtime. They let so much more media down. So we don't get, before they set up the stage for the trophy, I think it's important to get there to the athlete right away, their emotion, just like when I talked to Mahomes and Andy Reid right after their first Super Bowl when Fox had that. So I was fighting through the crowd. I didn't see the cameraman or our you know, producers in our ear saying, he's like, are you on? You got him. We got to go. And so they had to take an overhead camera as I elbows. But when I got to Tom, I mean, the guy's exhausted. They had just scored in overtime and the comeback. And I said, Tom, can we do this interview? He goes, can I have a little bit of time? I said, we really can't. So in fairness to him, and I just said, let's go. And I said, hey, we're live with with Tom Brady on Fox. So he had to answer me, and he did. And that was what I think he had an illness in the family behind the scenes that people didn't know about. So it was a very emotional, draining experience for him. But I appreciated him because of that moment. No matter what he said, just to see him, I think, mattered to people. Whereas Belichick was one-word answers and felt – it was like the little kid when he lost that Super Bowl after the perfect season where he just was like, I don't know how to act kind of a thing. And he's, in the meantime, retired and certainly not a bad broadcaster, actually, in that regard. Neither one of them are.
I think they're both doing great. Chris Meyer. Thanks so much. Congratulations on the book. That deserves a wow. Go pick it up. It's fantastic. Chris, go get him, and I'll see you on One Nation over the weekend. Don't move.
Yeah, I look forward to being on with you. Always fun talking to you, Brian. Great seeing you out at the sporting events when we do.
Right, you got care. It, and I'll see you at the Super Bowl.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Yeah, welcome back, everyone. Hey, I'm going to have a chance. I know it seems like forever, but after the inauguration, after Thanksgiving, after Christmas, I'll be on stage one of my favorite cities over in Jacksonville at the Florida Theater. I just talk about being able to bring my books to life, all 7 bestsellers, including my 2 sports books, inspirational, motivational, and patriotic. Those are the things I thought was... I would be able to put together over the last 2 years. I did something like this at a theater locally. We expanded the show. We bring in skits, and we have a great time. I'll put a tape online shortly, but if anyone of the WOKV listeners wants to come out, especially WDBO, we have 7 Florida stations, Georgia stations, right in the area. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com and order tickets. Make it a weekend. It's a Saturday night. Starts at 8 o'clock, and it's a lot of fun. And then afterwards, I'll be able to take your questions, sign books, T-shirts, T-shirt cannons, and I'll be able to talk about Thomas Jefferson, the Tripoli Pirates, George Washington's Secret Six, Andrew Jackson, the Miracle of New Orleans, Sam Houston and the Alamo Avengers, the President and Freedom Fighter, Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, and, of course, Teddy and Booker T, which is my latest, as well as The Games Do Count, and it's how you play the game. It's fun, and it's just great. And we'll be able to talk about this past election and talk about the inauguration, because I'll be covering, I covered both, and we'll be covering the inauguration too. And may I add, the Super Bowl.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Here we go. Latest minutes of the show. Grip Jenkins at the bottom of the hour, inside immigration, enforcement of the border, and so much more. That is the hot topic today as Donald Trump impatiently waits to take over a country that Joe Biden's trying to, plot against. If you look at some of the things he's been doing, and I'll get into that shortly, whether it's foreign policy or domestic. Sandra Smith is standing by, too, to bring us up to date on what goes on. Before we get to the big three, just a quick note. In the most unjust thing possible, Jussie Smollett is guilty as the day is long of making up some type of assault claim, and it turned out to be totally fictitious, was convicted of it, and now his conviction is overturned, saying he was targeted. Unbelievable, and it can't be retried. I hope this guy does not work again. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Matt Gaetz is not the best choice, and it's not Republicans who have dirtied him up. This is a guy who stood on this floor of the House and drove the House into chaos. He's burned bridges with the Republican Party.
Right. Mark Thiessen, Trump Team 2, Hegseth visits the halls of the Capitol building today, meeting with different senators. Matt Gaetz yesterday taking on his critics and his past. Will it work to get him through? We'll talk about another move by Trump to be cutting edge, and that is a czar for crypto. We'll keep you informed.
Number two.
Elon and I are going to start a separate track of Dogecasts that explain exactly what we're doing to the public, to provide transparency, to lift the curtain, to take us behind the scenes of what actually that waste, fraud, and abuse in government looks like.
Right, and they'll have a TV show too, Doge Duo. Elon and Vivek detail their mission and their methods of massively shrinking the size of the government and cutting trillions out of the budget. Can it work? They write about it and are willing to talk about it along the way.
Number one.
This horrific individual robbed us all of our hopes and dreams for Lakin. Your Honor, I'm asking you to please give Jose Ibarra the same thing he gave us when he made the choice to take Lakin's life and destroy ours.
Right. He's got life in prison, but it should be death. Lakin's Riley's senseless, horrific murder, whose killer was convicted and sentenced within 2 weeks, shows exactly why Donald Trump was selected as president, because her killer should never have been to the country, never been flown to Georgia, and his remorseless demeanor in the face of this murder shows the urgency in these blue states for these mayors and governors to start cooperating and getting them out. Sandra Smith joins us now, co-anchor of America Reports. Great to see you, Sandra.
Good to see you. What a day. What a busy, crazy, crazy day. Where do we begin?
I know.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on. We don't know how Pete's meetings are going.
So I just came off the air. I was anchoring newsroom this morning, and we were watching for the comings and goings. We hadn't really seen anybody. We know these meetings are happening. We know the lawmakers have serious questions right now. I think this transition is, it's going. It started off like a bat out of hell, right? But this is the process. And thankfully, they started early. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a few things happening. And that is a lot of nominees are going to go up. I mean, we got two more months. We got to wait till January 3rd to start this. We act like it's next week. I mean, it's still November. So we got December to go through, and we'll see how this goes and who comes forward. What do you think the problem is at Treasury? What do you think's going on there?
This is the one I'm watching. This is obviously a critical time for whoever's going to head up Treasury. I feel like the economic picks have been slow. We know one of them was rumored to be somebody in this building. That's not happening.
Larry Kudlow?
Yeah.
He's not going to do it.
Right. Commerce Secretary, Treasury. It's sort of like you'd think sort of he would have started off with his economic choices. Charlie Gasparino sort of says he's got an inkling of who this was. I think the latest talk was Hagerty, and he showed up at the Texas launch, right, with Elon Musk and Donald Trump, that perhaps he's going to be the Treasury Secretary. I don't know. I don't know that the decision has been made, and I don't think that there's a favorite right now. But what I do know is that one of the biggest promises that Donald Trump made during his campaign was on the economy. And number one priority has to bring prices down. So there's going to be a huge task to talk about spending, which, you know, Elon Musk is doing with Doge, right? We're going to address these all this empty workspace. They're going after stay-at-home workers in the federal government. All those are good things. But bottom line, what voters spoke loud and clear about in this election is prices. And you still have grocery prices up 25%. You still have, you know, gas prices up 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the biggest focus is going to have to be there. So I'm very curious with the transition team, who more of the economic players are going to be. We just don't know that yet.
So in the Wall Street Journal today, Musk and Ramaswamy get into detail, emphasize their interest in rolling back the red tape. Well, who's pro red tape? No one says, I have an idea. Let's slow things down. It just happens. So can they go in there and through executive orders get stuff done? And they go on to say some things that they will do. But what I think most is intriguing is they're going to keep us informed and they're open to suggestions. So Elon Musk and Vivek say they will help former federal employees transition into the private sector. So rather than just say, hey, you're fired. Number two is they're going to have almost a looks like a YouTube show. And they're going to say every day, this is what we're doing. This is what we're cutting. This is the
turbulence we're having. Do you know what I thought when I saw that? I was like, where do they have time for all this?
Because they got to run their companies.
They got to run their companies, too. But that's why I thought the word I was just looking for.
I just hope they can staff because they need help.
But not just anybody. They need good help. They need smart minds in there. What I thought was interesting was that they said, I was looking for their exact words, Musk and Ramaswamy say they are going to serve as outside volunteers and that they're going to make recommendations that allow the Trump administration to, quote, cut the federal government down to size. Their primary focus, they said, is cutting down federal agencies, which they view as wasteful and anti-democratic. Look, there's huge support for this. But to your point, they need a team. They need time.
Mm-hmm.
The messaging is there. The support for it's there. It's popular. But can they do it? And then you've got those on the left who are, you know, saying that this is going to have huge economic consequences, that the nation will suffer as a result of the moves they're making. What was the sound we played out last hour? Elizabeth Warren is saying, before they go after these federal workers, they need to go after their own bank accounts.
Yeah, here we are. Cut 11.
Look, he's talking about doing $2 trillion cuts, financing it with things like taking away people's Social Security in order to be able to do more giveaways for billionaires. This is all about choices. We just did a full hearing on tax cuts for billionaires. Not one single Republican showed up to talk about it. That really shocks me.
Number one, can you stop saying because he's a billionaire, his tax plan gave tax cuts to billionaires? The stats don't read that way, and she should know the election's over. So I don't know what she's talking about.
She should know what the election was about and what voters what voters said in this election. Guess what? Elon Musk pretty popular. Vivek Ramaswamy's pretty popular. Again, though, huge task at hand. I also like that they're talking about small business a lot. I think there's room for a lot of improvement when it comes to creating a business friendly environment. I think a lot of our small businesses became very discouraged over the past 4 years. Number one priority, Trump has said, is to lower their taxes, right, and roll back those regulations. But again, this is a lot. So I'm glad they got started early.
Right. I'm glad they're doing it. And so I said this to Joe Lonsdale with Palantir, and the audience has heard this. So on Friday, he came on and he says he's great friends with Elon Musk. And I asked him, do you want to play a role in this? He goes, I will play a role. I go, but they're going to need ramp up time to know how the government works to fix it. And he told me I'm wrong. He says any outside contractor like us, like Musk, Vivek and Joe Lonsdale, he says we know the problems because we know how long certain things take. We know where it gets gummed up. We know where the graft is. We know where the waste is. We know what's taking a long time. We know exactly. He goes, don't think they don't know exactly where they're going. And I was encouraged by that. And I thought about that. Outside vendors know what it's like to, number one, dealing with other companies as opposed to the federal government. And then you see, you know, a lot of people know how to work around the federal government and maybe upcharge the federal government. Maybe they know of people that do that. They could bring it in. You know, we hear about how much toilet seats cost, conference room tables cost, empty buildings that are out there. I want to see Elon Musk in front of an empty building and say, this is costing the taxpayers X, Y, and Z in heating, in oil, in rent, and the vacancies. We got to get rid of this building, and we need to see that.
Guess what happens when you try to hire in Washington right now? The first question is, can I work from home full time? This is what they're dealing with. So naturally what's going to happen is if they force 5-day work weeks from the office, you're going to get a big dropout of the workforce. If people aren't willing to commit to that. Naturally, then if you have a decline in the workforce, right, and you get those numbers down, the headcounts down, you're going to have, and by the way, this is also going to happen naturally when you roll back all these regulations. When you don't have to impose these regulations, you don't have to have staff to run them, right? And that's going to naturally lead in head. So this isn't going to like, they're going to show up and be like, you out of here. This is going to be somewhat of a natural, efficient process. It should be pretty efficient when they get in there.
But the problem is, and you stop me if I'm wrong, Sandra, it would be the civil workers unions.
Yeah.
So
get in the way.
Yeah, I don't even know why there's unions for that. If you're already a government worker.
It'll be a process.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. A couple other things are going on a note that's worth, and it's overdue. I'm surprised we don't talk more about it. Mm-hmm. XL Pipeline's going back. They already contacted
Canada.
Don't
know yet.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I've seen reports that he is asking his team to look into it.
Why wouldn't they?
Well, because we know that it's basically been dismantled. I mean, the concrete, the structures for the pipeline and everything that has already been dismantled. And by the way, we're at record oil production. So you have to ask if there's going to be support for taking that project back up again. You already have the workers that have gone away. You've got the existing pipeline has been dismantled already. The reports I saw on Politico was that Trump likes the idea of looking like we're ramping up production, that we're pro oil, pro fossil fuels, and that we're going to get this going again. So he's asking about it, is the report, right? Like, maybe we will start talking about get this going. I have not seen confirmation,
Sandra,
that he is.
We don't have, you and I don't have excess income. But if we were, I would bet you anything that thing's going again. Because they did build, under Obama, a portion of it. So it was green-lighted. The Nebraska end of it, remember he showed up there? I guarantee you they're going to build it again. The oil didn't go away. And as you know better than me with your business background, we are increasing oil production, but not nearly at the capacity we could if we went all in on it. And remember, we paused on new oil and gas leases, and we stopped exporting oil and gas to our allies like Japan. I think all that is going to be so easy to reverse and give an impact. And also, if you're going to start smothering Iran and going to start sanctioning countries like China for using their discounted oil, I believe that you have to show everyone, I can replenish the global oil market with our own production. So don't worry about the impact Iran will have.
So this is what I was digging into. So TC Energy is the name of the company that owned the pipeline system that the Keystone was intended to complement. They have gotten out of the deal, right? They're already gone. Portions of the pipeline also that had been put into the ground in anticipation of this happening have been dug up. So replacing that would require a lot of money. You'd have to get a company back on board to do so. I mean, I'm not saying it's not possible. And should we? I mean, yeah, we're sitting on the resources. We should max them out. There's no question. Could he get this done in 4 years? I don't know.
I mean, the thing is, it's got to be done in 4 years. Also, in the as you know, in the tax reform, I don't know how it fit in, but ANWR was supposed to be explored, and it just stopped doing it. They said, we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. Well, without passing a law, all you do is renew the tax reform. You got to go back to ANWR. Mm-hmm. That's another wellspring of oil you could be bringing back into the system.
We should be a net energy exporter on all levels. There's no reason why we cannot. There's no reason to hold back. We have the resources. It's just going to take, you have to have the right minds. You have to have the right companies. It's going to take lining this up. So I'm going to wait and see. I have not seen this formally introduced by Trump's team yet.
We'll take a short time out, come back. Sandra's going to tell us what's coming up on our other show, which is from 1 to 3.
Yeah.
Because you've been going nonstop.
Yeah.
And you're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Turn around for me. Why? Because you're under arrest.
For what?
For the incident we talked about earlier today. What am I under arrest for?
For reckless endangerment.
And how was I recklessly endangering my child?
We're not talking about it.
So, Aaron, call mommy and tell them they're taking me to jail because you decided to walk down the street.
Let go of your hands.
That's not his fault.
Yeah, call mommy.
You're the mother. That's your responsibility.
Yeah,
keep
I need
your
you
child.
To not talk to me, please.
Okay. That's
okay,
sure.
Soren, give her a call. Okay. Last time I checked, it wasn't illegal for a kid to walk to the store. So.
It is when they're 10 years old.
It is?
Yes.
Okay, I'd like to see that on the books.
Okay, well, you'll see it on your warrant.
So a little kid was told he could walk to downtown in Fannin County, Georgia. And it turns out in that county, this kid is not allowed at 10 years old to walk to the store. So they arrested his mom, Brittany Peterson. And you just heard the exchange there with cops. She has no problem saying, I let my 10-year-old walk down there. The cops have no problem saying you're under arrest. You're a mom, Sandra. Who's right?
This is nuts. And if you watch the body cam video, the footage reveals a mother who is in shock. She's a mom of four kids. Apparently, she hadn't given him the permission to do this. But even if she had, it wouldn't have constituted a criminal act. I guess there's no reckless endangerment charge in Georgia. She was charged with reckless conduct, which is punishable by up to a year in jail and $1,000 fine. But bottom line, we're talking about a 10-year-old kid walking a mile to town. I don't know. I think there's probably a lot of people listening who have their kids walk a lot farther or ride their bikes a lot farther to go to their towns, get ice cream, go to the candy store. I think people are in shock at the state of police intervening to this degree. I'm not sure exactly.
It says, under Georgia state law, kids between the age of 9 and 12 can be left alone for up to 2 hours. And Patterson had left Soren, who was just days from turning 11, at home with his grandfather for 90 minutes. She did not give Soren permission to walk to town by himself, although if she had, it would not have been constituted as a criminal act. So the cops clearly are way over the top on this.
I still just don't get it. So when I watched the video, you realize there was sort of this hostility there with the cop, Officer Robertson, telling her, okay, turn around. The mother asked why. Because you're under arrest. The two officers then proceeded to turn the mother around. They pushed her sleeves up above her wrists, cuffed her behind her back. This as her 10-year-old son was watching from inside of the house, Brian. Think about the damage that could do. So I hope that they're able to work this out. I kept thinking as I watched this, and as many probably listening right now, is there something more to the story than this?
The neighbor saw him walking. He says the female stranger who saw Soren walking down the street asked if he was okay and was told yes, but the stranger called 911 anyway. When the sheriff answered the call, that should have been the end of it. But she went on to describe how the call would have gone. Is he in distress? No. Is he on fire? No. Is he a lion eating him? No. Then Skenazy said the sheriff should have said, that's it. But he didn't. He went for the arrest.
As my parents always said when they checked on me, 10 fingers, 10 toes. Okay, what's the problem? So apparently, she said on the record, to be clear, I've always had the utmost respect for law enforcement.
Watch Sandra between 1 and 3 today. America Reports.
Thanks for having me.
She'll play herself.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm not in favor of sending the army in uniforms into our cities to collect people. I think it's a terrible image, and that's not what we use our military for. We never have. And it's actually been illegal for over 100 years to bring the army into our cities. Army and our military are trained to shoot the enemy. They're not trained to get a warrant to do what they're doing. The police have a difficult job. But the people removing people from our country need to be a police enforcement domestic agency, not the military. All for remain in Mexico, yeah. I will not support an emergency to put the army into our cities. I think that's a huge mistake.
That is Rand Paul saying he's not for the removal process. Don't use the army. I don't know. Does that count the National Guard? Griff Jenkins with me now. Nobody knows more about the border, the challenges with immigration than him. Griff, you got a lot of things to do. We got 10 quality minutes, so let's get to it. Rand Paul talking about something that Trump's not going to do? I don't think he was going to use the U.S. Army.
I think the important thing to focus on is that's far down the road. We know there's 1.4 million illegal criminal aliens in the country that have been marked for deportation already by an immigration judge. 13,000, some of them, are already in ICE custody. So you start getting rid of them right away. But, you know, ICE is very good at this stuff. I spend a lot of time with ICE. They know how to do this. And when Tom Homan is on our air talking about, look, if sanctuary cities, Massachusetts Governor Mara Healey won't cooperate, then get the hell out of the way. Let me tell you, that's going to work. They're going to go after these people.
How would you do it? So you have a criminal in prison. They show up with the detainer. I'd like that guy. And the sanctuary cities go, we're not letting you in the prison, and you're not going to get him, right?
Well, that's going to be a lot of the legal fighting, perhaps, if a jail won't allow them to take somebody. But the 13,000 we're talking about are already in ICE custody, and it doesn't look like this administration
is ICE custody jail.
Yeah, well, they're holding them in ICE custody, okay. So all you got to do is walk them out to an airplane and fly them home. There's a problem too, and that is the reciprocal countries, right? Venezuela particularly doesn't accept refugees, and China doesn't very well as well. And so you're going to have to figure out, we've got so many Venezuelan criminals here. Look at Lake and Riley. You know, I confirmed through DHS sources that not just the brother, but Jose Ibarra was linked to Trent de Aragua. And you've got in Houston, Jocelyn Ungaray's thug killers. They were TDA. So you've got Venezuela, even if they were going to cut a deal, which Trump says is going to try and renegotiate, they're not going to take their most violent criminals back. Why would they? And the other alternative, in talking to folks like Homan and Stephen Miller, asked, because I've been saying, listen, get me up to speed. What's the thinking? They say, you know, renegotiate, which maybe the word is coerce these countries to take their people back, whatever it is, tariffs, threatening, whatever. The alternative is to find a safe third country, that where they could be safe from prosecution as they claim asylum from their countries, but not in the U.S. What's that look like? Guatemala, Honduras. They're not going to want to take the worst of the worst either.
Which El Salvador just arrested all their criminals famously, and they cleaned up their streets for the first time. So can you just drop them in anyway with an army plane and just say, here, your people back?
Well, that causes obviously quite a stir, but who knows? Maybe the incoming Trump administration is willing to do that. I think, though, you know, one thing that doesn't get much credit, and that is Trump has been vilified for saying that these countries are emptying their prisons.
It's 100% right.
It's 100% right. In the case of Trent de Aragua, or TDA, as we know, move over MS-13, it's TDA now, began in a violent prison in the city of Aragua, in the Tocaron prison. 10 years ago, this gang took that prison over, were running it, and now they're all in 16 states. Tennessee, the Tennessee Bureau of the TBI guys, have all four major cities in Tennessee now have a TDA problem. Knoxville, Memphis, Nashville. And, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to figure, so even if we can do mass deportations, if the administration can get it, you know, going, where are you going to put these people and what's going to stop them from coming back, right? Like in the case of Jose Ibarra, Jose Ibarra was living for like 10 years in Honduras happily. Then he sees that this new administration, Joe Biden's administration, made it super easy to just walk across and get released. So that's what he did in 2022. In 2023, he's hanging out in New York up to no good, gets arrested, NYPD releases him. So I think, obviously, they're going to have a hard time coming back under the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. It's going to be different. They're going to harden the border. But at the same time, sending them to, if not their original country, you've got to bet they're going to try and come back across.
Right. So the remain in Mexico, does Mexico have to say yes to it?
Mexico does have to say yes. And that's going to be a negotiating point. Look, make no mistake, Mexico's
have a new leader now. Obrador's out.
Carla Sheinbaum is the president, and she's holding a lot of cards, because she is going to decide whether or not you can reinstate remain in Mexico, whether or not they're willing to take people. Because remember, flights are expensive and difficult. But in remain in Mexico, you cross legally, you get turned around and walk right back across. And this is an economic problem, as I've reported from places like Juarez, in Matamoros, in Tijuana. These border towns suffer greatly from having an influx of homeless migrants that, you know, are participating and draining city resources and then also committing petty crimes. They don't want them there. So it's going to be very fascinating. I would not be surprised if one of the first foreign dignitary president visits, big summits of sorts, everyone's like China or maybe Russia. Don't underestimate that Mexico in a meeting with the Mexican president could be early and fast, because they need to sort out and iron out things which are going to be very different than they are now.
And Griff, you got to go get those 20,000 Mexican Marines on their southern border. And maybe there won't be a big influx to hold on our southern border.
Well, that's right. And
they were effective when they wanted to be.
They
correct?
Were effective. And we went down there on the border in Tapachula, the southernmost.
We covered it live.
I did a live shot floating on a raft in the Suchiate River, separating Guatemala and southern Mexico, where they're just coming across. And we did see the presence. They're going to have to stand that up. I will say that Border Patrol, the chief of the Border Patrol particularly tells me that they have been pretty successful in getting other countries like Colombia and Panama to try and harden the flow. They even under the Biden administration, notwithstanding, they have those countries, Colombia and Panama particularly, because they go through that Darien Gap, which we went through, they've gotten much better at trying to slow this down. So maybe that's something that the Trump administration can actually build on.
But that's what you need. You need your Secretary of State, the State Department, working out there going, guys, you got to do me a favor here, whether it's threats or aid, whatever it is. But it's got to be a whole holistic. It can't be I'm going to bring Visa down to Bolivia and going to revitalize their economy. That's right. What our former border czar did. It's got to be all hands in, so you got to slow it down. Now, the chances of getting rid of that app that says Cuba, Nicaraguans, Haitians,
CHNV's dead.
And Venezuela.
It's going to die,
which means you can apply in your country and you get to come in.
Dead on arrival. The CBP One app is going nowhere. That's going to end as well.
Will that stop a flow immediately? Will we feel that immediately?
I think, yes, you will certainly see numbers go down, because remember,
because they weren't crossing the border anyway.
We've seen numbers. The whole idea behind the CBP One app was to get people to do it through the legal pathway. We created a legal pathway. But in retrospect, all it is just having them not cross the river. They just get to get let in. And in some cases, in CHNV, flown in. That is certainly, you can
who
bet.
Who paid for that flight?
End. Well, the flights actually aren't taxpayer dollars.
Good.
They have to have a sponsor. So they have to pay for the flight and have a sponsor. But as we know, in the case of a lot of the crimes committed by people that came through that program, the sponsors weren't really helping out.
Griff Jenkins, what is the attitude among Border Patrol since the election?
In their words, as one told me, they're ecstatic. And they are hoping that Chief Owens, Jason Owens, stays on, because he's weathered the storm. But he never lost the integrity of the men and women in green. He never lost their confidence in him to try and stand up and push back as best they could in an unwinning situation.
Are you in outnumbered today?
I'm on outnumbered.
Last question then. Last question. on the border right now, when you look at what has taken place over the last 4 years, gut feeling, just gut, was it intentional? Or did this thing get so out of control they didn't know how to stop it?
If it was, who knows? But if it was
what
intentional.
What do you think? And you talk to people.
When I talk to people, a lot of people think it was intentional to particularly gain support in the Democratic Party from Hispanic voters. And what did we see? Exactly the opposite, Brian. The Fox News voter analysis after the election showed in Massachusetts, Trump was plus 15 with Hispanic voters. In Colorado, plus 10. So all the areas that were hit hardest, in New York, it was 12% increase in Hispanic voters. All the places where we saw the worst of crime from illegal aliens, we saw an increase in Hispanic voters. So I think if it was intentional and that was their plan, they read that wrong.
But if those people that got here illegally got citizenship, that might be to their advantage, because they do pull higher towards what they think is the Democratic Party permissiveness. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
But that's a long time down the road. No one's giving them citizenship right now.
No, it's a long time down the road. And the pathway to citizenship isn't something that Trump has explicitly said, no, that's a deal breaker. So we'll see where it goes. There's still the DACA kids to deal with.
I know where you're going. You're going outnumbered. You're going to be the man in the middle.
I'm the man in the middle. We're going to talk about everything. Jesse Smollett. We're going to talk about the border stuff. And we're going to talk about that crazy Jaguar. I think right. That's how you say it. Jaguar ad.
Doesn't matter. We can't afford it. Back in a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So Daniel Penny, realistically here, was forced to step up against a very flawed system that nobody seems to be interested in fixing, that Alvin Bragg is very much a part of. And the results of that are exactly what you're talking about. People on the subway, when a crazy gets on, it's threatening, and it happens all day, every day, stare at their phones, look at their feet, and just say, please pass me by. And nobody wants to get involved. And the repercussions are everywhere.
Right, and that is Paul Morrow weighing in on the Danny Penny defense. And we saw, and you could see it too, a half-hour Danny Penny talking to cops in an interrogation room without a lawyer, just telling the officers exactly what happened. And he looks like a hero. He gives a flawless testimony. I don't know if people are going to find holes in the prosecution, but there is no justice. It makes me wonder if there's more to know.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
Yeah, we'll go back to the Jenny Penny story, but Jesse Smollett's conviction is overturned. This is nuts. A deal's done that means that Jesse Smollett's conviction in the hate crime hoax case is now reversed. The Illinois High Court ruled this morning that Jesse's deal with Cook County prosecutors when they originally dropped the case against him had to be honored. The court's ruling says that Jesse held up his end of the deal, and he actually did 18 hours of community service. We all know he lied, he embarrassed himself, and destroyed his career. He had been sentenced to 30 months of probation with the first 150 days to be served in Cook County. This is absolutely insane. He's the now personification of someone who looks you in the eye and lies and now gets away with it. Next, Eva Longoria has left the dystopian U.S. for Mexico and Spain. But don't worry, she's going to be fine. She's not the only one that's leaving, by the way. Ellen and Portia, they are a couple. They are leaving, too. They're going to England and not coming back. Could Robert De Niro be next? I don't want to live in a country where people that hate Trump don't feel comfortable. I'm not sure. I guarantee you, anyone who does leave will be coming back. A recent interview with Marie Claire to commemorate her showbiz career as it nears her fifth decade, although we only know she's done Desperate Housewives. Has she been in anything else?
She's been in other things, but that's her most famous role.
I get to escape and go somewhere else. Most Americans aren't so lucky. Next. We are lucky that you're leaving. Ellen DeGeneres, the same thing. I did that story already. Next, secondhand. You can swish me again. Secondhand germs, vintage clothing in thrift shops can be covered in disease-causing bacteria. Yep, research has found that clothing can harbor many infections, including germs like something unpronounceable. Just think of staph infections, bacteria, salmonella, E. coli. A survey of secondhand clothing specifically, which was being sold in Pakistan, detected the presence of all types of stuff. This, I feel bad. Now when we give clothes to the needy, now we might be poisoning them. Are we not supposed to keep our clothes? Should we throw our clothes out now? Have we made a decision on this, Eric or Pete?
I mean, all this secondhand stuff that I had growing up, either from older relatives or from
family
friends.
How did you survive?
I don't know. That could explain a lot, though.
Next, a man was forced to tweet for help when he got locked in a department store after falling asleep on a massage chair. This is so much wrong here. A man awoke at a deserted shop after dozing off an electronics store in Japan, identified only by his Twitter handle. The sleepy customer was forced to tweet his plight when he discovered he was locked. Posting various photos of dark and empty interior, he captioned the photo, "Oh man, I'm locked in." It is thought that the man triggered an alarm which notified the police. Any thoughts? Does this ever remind you of anything? Have you ever fallen asleep in like a Macy's trying on socks?
Yeah, I've only seen this in comedy shows and movies, not in real life.
How does no one notice the guy there?
you know, he's probably quiet. He might have nodded off. Those chairs are comfortable. Sharper Image chairs, right? I mean, that's the only one.
True.
I actually bought a Sharper Image chair for my mom, and she hated it. And then I didn't know how to give it back. It was so hard to get it upstairs. Somehow, even though I bought it, my brother ended up with it. Pete, have you? Can you follow that story? Can you follow?
Yeah,
that?
I'll need contacts on your brother to figure out how it's going. I want to know. I want to know when you gave it to him. Did you pass along any germs like those people?
Maybe.
That, yeah.
You don't want to get a used massage chair, or also when they tell you with a massage chair, I'll take the demo. You should not say yes to that. Next, the five best NHL players of all time, ranked by sports experts. Number five is Messier. Number four is Bobby Orr. Number three is Mario Lemieux. Number two is Gordie Howe. And number one is Wayne Gretzky. I saw Gordie Howe playing in the NHL for the WHL, AHA, at 50. I mean, that was so unbelievable. He played with his son.
And I don't know what you think, but Wayne Gretzky, deservedly number one. He may, even though he's considered the best, he may still be underrated. It's amazing the feats that he accomplished in hockey are still unfathomable today.
And he's one of these guys, one of the nicest guys you're ever going to meet. Real quick, can we go back to the Danny Penny story? Danny Penny and some of his testimony is so compelling that he gave it there without script and without counsel. Here's a little of Danny Penny describing his story. Cut 30.
I forget what stop it was at, but some guy came in and he's like, whipped his jacket off and he's like, I'm gonna kill everybody. I can go to prison forever. I don't care. I don't do this. At that point, I looked to the person next to me like, hey, just hang on to this phone for me. I had my headphones in and took it off and just kind of like grabbed him from behind because he came in just to like, because he was acting like a lunatic, like a crazy person. So, and he was rolling around the floor. And at that point, the train stopped. It was like, someone called the cops. And he's still like rolling around, still going crazy. I had two other guys kind of help me just kind of keep him from. I'm going nuts, and yeah,
that's when he
came.
Guy's a hero. You talk to the other people there, they were scared, burying each other's in their friend's chest, saying, hope he doesn't hit me. He was on all types of drugs. Meanwhile, just across town, he had one guy just stabbing three people randomly. Another guy was robbing people with 17 prior arrests, and you're cracking down on Danny Penny in New York City.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. This week, I'm joined by retired San Francisco police captain Yolanda Williams as she details her escape from the People's Temple cult. Available now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.